Welcome underground. My co-host spent a pleasant day exploring some of Oxford's more niche museums and had some thoughts. Because what are museums for? We propose that we should abandon any notion of them being for the transmission of propositional knowledge and instead see them as a vibe, an aesthetic, a home of the muses. We recorded this before the British Museum decided to send the Elgin Marbles to a museum in Athens. Perhaps relevant. Don't know. Enjoy.
I went to a museum the other day. I went to Pitt Rivers, the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. I spent a whole day going around museums in Oxford. It was very nice.
It's a Sunday out. Or did you hit the Ashmolean?
I didn't actually, funny enough. Oh. I've been to the Ashmolean plenty of times. I decided to go to the more obscure museums.
Okay.
Yeah. And they weren't all museums, actually. Some of them were galleries, I guess. I went to the History of Science. Is it the Science Museum or the History of Science Museum?
Museum of History of Science. That's the one.
Yeah,
The one. It's like 100 astrolabes.
Yes.
And Einstein's blackboard.
That's about it. Yeah,
and
I know.
Nothing else.
Oh, and a thing about Philip Pullman, and there's like the alethiometer from Lyra's Oxford, which is just an invented thing. It was from the film. I actually did quite enjoy seeing that because I loved those books when I was younger, very much younger. But yeah, Einstein's blackboard, that's pretty cool though. I mean,
you probably had a few.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know. I thought that was cool. I was pleased to see Einstein's blackboard with his sort of equations on it about, you know, black holes or whatever it is. As you can see, I paid attention while I was there.
Yeah.
What was the other one? I went to, as I said, the Pitt Rivers. And then I went to the Western Library, which was not open when we were there, but is now open.
It was a reading room when we were there.
Yes, yeah, but now it's like a whole kind of bougie thing.
Okay. And I had to go in there for like Enlightenment French stuff.
nice. What were you doing with Enlightenment French stuff?
There was some module on it. Apparently encyclopedias are important and like
right. Yeah. Yeah, sounds it.
Yeah, I thought about it very hard for 2 weeks, so then I thought about it again. Wrote some essays, don't know what on.
Yeah. Yeah, fair. But anyway, you know, now it's this incredibly bougie kind of like public facing space, and they have a sort of an exhibition space in there, and it was on oracles and sort of soothsaying and you know, predicting the future and all that kind of thing. Yeah, it was awesome. It was actually really good.
Yeah.
Small but really good. They had a piece of Oxyrhynchus papyri with a papyrus with some astrology, I think, on it.
cool symbols. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they had a, I think, 16th century astrological almanac. And then they had a sort of an iPhone next to it, and they had them sort of lined up all by their side. And I thought that was really cool because they were all about the same size. And, you know, the thing was that, you know, this is the different ways that people have interacted with astrology over time. Well, you know what? That's a really neat little display there. That made me reflect and ponder and go, huh.
Yeah, was that the entire museum? It was just like those two items.
It's the bit I remember. No, I
coffee shop, yeah.
No, there was more.
That would be more powerful if you just distorted that.
Yeah. No, there was some interactive things, and there were lots of cool photos. There was actually a photo of the chicken oracle from the Azande, which I'm talking about
The Azande
is the people with whom the famous anthropologist Evans Pritchard spent some time. In the 1920s, I think it was the 20s or 30s. And he wrote some quite famous scholarly works about witchcraft among the Azande. And in those works, it talks about this chicken oracle, which is basically where it doesn't have to be a chicken, to be clear, but I call it the chicken oracle because it's what sticks in my mind, where you have a... there's a poisonous root that they have access to. I think it's strychnine. It's a you know, derivation of a form of it, and they'll feed it to, or they'll put some on a leaf and put it in front of the chicken and the chicken will kind of peck about at it. And if the chicken dies, that's one answer. And if it doesn't die, that's the other answer.
Mm.
And apparently this is a fairly common way of doing it. But I think, and I've never been able to actually locate this in his writings, and believe me, I've tried, but I somehow I picked up this idea with quite a lot of certainty that Evans Pritchard himself lived for a certain amount of time making decisions using the chicken oracle and reported that it's perfectly fine as a way of making decisions about your life. It works perfectly well. It's just as good as any other way. it's absolutely fine to do.
You can probably stack your deck a bit. Like, well, once you know your chicken psychology and how to restrict
me. Yeah, maybe.
you can put your thumb on the scale.
maybe. I haven't thought of that bit. But the bit that stays with me is that he was like, no, it's fine. It works really well. as a sort of scholarly insight, which I've always remembered.
That would be on brand for 1920s anthropology.
Yeah, but it also explains why oracles and stuff is so ubiquitous through sort of history and civilizations, because they actually work pretty well. And actually, it's a neat sort of psychological insight in the fact that, quite a lot of the time when we think we're kind of being incredibly rational and sort of, dwelling on a decision and trying to come to the sensible decision, we might as well flip a coin most of the time.
Well, I mean, but the counter to that is that most of the time you just need a decision, then you commit to it and do it, and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And just the more time you spend dithering, the worse it's going to get.
Yeah.
And I find that, people who've been through Sandhurst in the army, like, they have an incredibly low threshold for making a decision. Like, really, after 5, maybe 10 seconds, it's like, any decision is better than no decision. Okay, we're doing this, let's do it.
Mm.
Which leads to some friction with my family, because I like to give it the extra 10 seconds to kind of think about factors. But at some point, you do need a cutoff so you can make a decision, so you can just do something.
Do you negotiate with the members of your family?
There's no negotiation.
No.
very high speed chicken oracle.
Yeah. Do you have ranks when you're all together? Is rank respected?
No. What we do is we assign a leader for a particular task. Just so there's one person who makes a decision.
Right.
Because if you're having to, come together as a group and work through everything at every turn on the road,
it gets pretty inefficient. When it's you, there's that 10 seconds of your father and brother, like, some steam coming out their ears.
Yeah, they don't like it.
I really, really, really like that image. That's a great image. Anyway, so I went to a few museums is the point. And,
to summarize.
I had a good time. And that made me think, let's talk about museums. Museums are interesting. Museums are weird. Museums, the one that really got me thinking about this is the Pitt Rivers, which is a kind of... it's like an OG museum, isn't it?
If you're in a weird museum, that's your room. Yeah.
And for those who haven't been there, it's a sort of anthropological museum, so it's actually quite small. I mean, it's a big hall, but there's so much stuff in there that it feels quite small. Yeah. It's incredibly dense. And it's not laid out like a sort of modern, airy, spacious kind of museum with like clean lines and all of that kind of thing. It really has that sort of 19th century vibe going on.
Yeah, dense wooden cabinets.
Wooden cabinets,
and they've all got drawers as well, which you can open. It's like more stuff. Yeah,
and you have a sort of a recreation of a sort of Bulgarian's peasant's house next to a canoe from Hawaii that's kind of hanging from the ceiling, and then you have some Japanese no masks, and you have a sort of a bone toothpick from some Native Americans, and it's all there, in sort of any particular arc of view. There's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on, and you've got the galleries above as well. So if you look up, there's more stuff. That massive totem pole, and
it is a very big totem pole.
Pitt Rivers was an explorer, so a lot of this stuff was stuff he brought back from his travels. But it was always described to me as a museum of museums. Like they had deliberately kind of left the layout as it was.
Mm.
Where, by my understanding, it isn't so much random. It is, stuff is collected together. But instead of having, this is the Egypt room and this is the Anglo-Saxon England room, this is the cabinet of spears from literally everywhere. This is the cabinet of model houses from everywhere.
Yeah.
This is the cabinet of fishing paraphernalia from everywhere. And so it gives a very different impression than the way most museums are laid out.
Yeah, so this is one of the this is clearly why it made me reflect on museums then. It's a meta museum. And yes, there's lots to talk about there. You kind of immediately jump forward to one of the things I want to talk about with museums.
Oh, sorry.
So I'm just going to, it's just going to be a bit of a, no, no, that's fine. We're just going to have to go to a, like a jump into warp speed immediately here.
Well, it's like a trip around the room. Yeah.
Epistemology, right?
Right.
So what do we actually learn from a museum? What knowledge is instantiated in an actual object? Okay, I have this whole thing with that. And then one of the crescendos of this point I was going to make about epistemology was I actually think that a good museum can epistemologically produce more than the sum of a particular collection's parts through really good curation and the co-presentation of different objects.
Yes. So should we go through that argument more slowly?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. and I guess that's, you know, that's what the pyramids are doing. So, right. Here's the question then. What does a museum actually teach us? You know, what do we learn by having objects, artifacts in a glass cabinet in front of us?
Yeah. So, if you look at museums now and the culture around museums, it's all about education. It's all about... literally, their mission is educating the masses.
I just don't think that's what museums are about. Again, jumping the gun here.
I don't think that's what museums are about at all. You look at the kids in the British Museum in the Egypt room. I don't think they're learning anything. They're just looking at cool mummies. And any knowledge they have about ancient Egypt is literally like they built pyramids and did mummies, and that's cool.
Yeah, and that's a mummy. Yeah.
While I fully support this, I don't think it's quite what people think they're doing when they put children in a museum.
No, totally. I could not agree more. And I think that, you know, I mentioned that we were going to be doing a podcast on museums to my wife, and she said, oh, you know, what do you think? Do you think museums actually work in their sort of, you know, educative purpose? Like, do you think you actually learn anything from a museum? And I was like, well, you've hit the nail on the head. Like, yeah, I'm absolutely right. You don't. That's because that's not what they're actually for.
Well, I think you do, but not directly. It's not in the way that curators think that we're learning.
No, exactly. You're not learning. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Brilliant. No, I think that I think that there's a hint in the name about the type of learning that you're getting, which is, you know, museon, right? Which is the sort of the building for the muses. Okay? Mm. So it's where the muses are, and the muses are, of course, the goddesses that inspire. They inspire you to create. And I think in that, as always, etymologically, is a big, big clue as to what you're actually gaining from a museum. But should we just let that dangle for a second and maybe we can talk through, you know, why?
Yeah.
So what do you think you're getting from a museum?
Well, for me, I mean, a lot of it is a vibe. Like, if I just want to just vibe in a space for a bit, I'll try and go to it. I mean... Again, you can't really go to the British Museum now because it's so crowded. But you know, a niche museum, like in London, you got the Sir John Soane Museum or the Petrie Museum of Egyptology, where they're generally completely empty and pretty random. And I just come out feeling energized. It's like your mind gets to go on holiday for an hour as you kind of wander around looking at these objects. I mean, I might learn something, but I doubt it. But I come out feeling inspired.
Yeah. It's the inspiration.
And again, you can have a good day in Oxford like you did. I often do when I go there. And you just wander around and you just come out feeling enriched and ready to create stuff.
Absolutely.
And live a better life.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, 100%. And it's largely an aesthetic experience. But what you're actually getting is a huge like panoply of images that might make an impact or might not. But I actually think that the impact of the image of the aesthetic is almost completely disassociated from any propositional knowledge or
absolutely, and even if
content.
You actually read the increasingly long labels on stuff, or especially you know those temporary exhibitions in the British Museum or something, there's reams and reams of text, and you know you see some people just reading it all, and you try reading it all, and it just doesn't stick. You don't feel it. You just look at the objects and get the vibe from that. And again, I think you have the curators kind of misunderstanding what's going on when they. You know, you've got thousands of words of analysis and explanation and narrative. And the exhibition would be equally effective if none of it was there at all.
I think that the intellect...
They almost distract because you then read the label first and you hardly look at the thing because you're being told that label's the important bit and the being educated. So you can't even come to your own sort of thoughts.
No.
You're told what to think.
And the sort of the intellectualizing, the breaking it down into kind of propositional knowledge, into kind of sentences that you would learn, you know, in a book or in a lecture. Mm. I'm in no way disparaging that form of knowledge at all. Like I'm pro knowledge.
It is good, yeah.
But you don't get, that's not what the museum is for. The museum is for the shock of the object, right? It's for it's to be actually confronted with a form that's whole, an artifact. That has a subjective valence, you know, it has a subjective power to you know crash into your consciousness and say, "Here, look, here I am. I'm an actual thing." And you know, when you study, I don't know, Greek vases, yeah, love a Greek vase. They're very interesting. They're fantastic to study because you can delineate, you know. Advancements in technology alongside aesthetic advancements alongside, you know, and you can link it to cultural developments and you can do all of this. There's loads to learn about Greek vases. Brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. But none of that is about the actual subjective experience of holding one. That's completely different. And I've been lucky enough to, you know, work somewhere where they had some Greek vases and I could go and sort of hold them and look at them.
That's
and
quite
do
high
all
pressure.
Yeah, it's all right. I wore, you know, the white gloves and everything. Felt like a very...
It doesn't help if you drop them, yeah.
No, well, I wasn't lifting them very far above the table under the watchful eye of the curator. What I was getting from that experience was nothing to do with understanding the sort of the development of the black figure technique or something like that. It was something completely different. And I think that's what you're getting in a museum. But then,
you know, you get that visual feeling of holding a pot. Then you can go back home and read all the books on it. And suddenly the books actually mean something. They're interesting to you.
Yeah.
In a way they might not have been initially.
Yeah, 100%. And because you've actually tangibly experienced something, even if it's behind a glass case, you know, looking at it in the flesh, as it were, with your eyes, as a sort of 3D object, as a form, an artifact, it gives your mind something to latch onto when you're sort of learning about it in a more abstracted intellectual sense, which is very helpful if you, you know, just for the learning. But I actually don't think it's, as I'm sure you agree, I don't think you need that later learning to justify going to have the experience at all. That experience has a value in and of itself. And I think you're right, the value is inspirational. I think that's why it's called a museum, is where the muses are. you know, that's really, you know, hitting the nail on the head. Clearly that's the value of going to a museum. I think that you can, when I went to the Pitt Rivers, I don't know what you feel about this, but I think when I've say held a Greek vase or a Roman coin or something like that, and it's, you know, it's a real one, and I've been lucky enough to do that a few times in my life. You kind of want to feel this incredible sort of connection to the past, because you think, well, I've got this coin in my hand and like actual Romans held this coin, you know, these people that I've spent a long time studying, you know, an actual person who actually lived held this coin and he was a Roman, and now I'm holding it. You know, and you really try hard to have this kind of amazing sort of epiphany of connection with, you know, Roman man X or Roman woman Y or whatever. Got this the wrong way around, didn't I? And but I never find that I do at all. And yeah. I think that because it's really just like holding a coin. It's like holding, frankly, a fairly badly made coin by modern standards.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. I love coins. I love Roman coins. But nevertheless, you know, that's what the experience actually is. And I don't think I didn't get any more sort of real frisson on a sort of...
Yeah, no, I always think on those kind of history programs on telly where they're like, you know, trying to give this frisson. Like, oh, this is held by an actual Roman.
Yeah.
Like, you're making this up, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and because it's no different from, say, like me touching the chair I'm sitting on and being like, gosh, this chair was, you know, held by an actual probably Chinese man in China who, like, helped make it or something, you know, that I don't know. It's no weirder than that, really.
Or this water I'm drinking has been drunk by seven people since it rained.
Yeah, or, you know, the stone of the wall of my building has been, you know, that was put in place by a stonemason in the 18th century. True, by the way, but it doesn't, I'm like, so? You know, we want to have this sense of connection to other people in the past through objects. They give us, there's this sense that they can connect us. But I think it's chimerical. You know, I really do. I don't think that really happens at all. And I don't think that's what it's about. But I think that what is interesting is that the objects, I think it's almost the other way around. We don't feel the connection to the people that made the objects because the object, when we're touching the objects, we're holding them, we're looking at them, tells us nothing about the people that made them or the people that held them. It tells us nothing at all. Like, we might have some overlap of sense data, you know, like, oh, the particular feel of the shape of this cup is something that has been particularly felt by another human being. That's so superficial, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like saying, you know, the sky is blue and that shade of blue has been seen by, you know, human beings in the past. Like, great. I mean, it is amazing, but it's also not, like, you know, it's not that interesting.
A bit banal.
It doesn't really tell us anything about the subjective reality of that person's life, which is what we're actually trying to connect to. It doesn't give us that at all, really.
I mean there's something not far off I sometimes get with some objects, and that is this person who used this 1,000 years ago, I kind of get him, or like he wasn't that different to me. Like so sometimes it's not connection or anything like that. It's realizing that the people who lived 5,000 years ago were pretty similar to us.
Okay. As in they've held it in the same way.
Yeah. Or, I mean, again, like, museums evolved out of cabinets of curiosities, and they like to have various objects around, for the same reason of the muses of sense. So whenever I find something interesting, you know, I bring it back and have it lying around, and then I get told I'm a hoarder. But here's a little hand axe I found in the Sahara Desert in Mauritania. So it's probably 5 or 10,000 years old.
And he's holding it up to the camera listeners.
Behold. So it's a sort of smooth round rock that's been honed into a sharp edge on one side. And just the way it fits so comfortably in the hand, and you can just see how useful it would be. It's actually a bit useful today sometimes. And just having... It's not interesting that someone was using this as a tool 5,000 years ago, but it is interesting that the tool's still useful.
I feel like that's a dark magic object you've got there. From something about the way you're talking about it, like, you know, it's so smoothly in the hand. It feels like you're talking about, like, the One Ring or something. Like, what have you found in the desert?
Well, this was around the Rishat structure. So it's this big geological feature in the middle of the Sahara. It's called the Eye of the Sahara. So it's about 40 miles wide. And so it can be seen from space, but it's a sort of series of concentric circles. So it looks a bit like an eye. Which I felt compelled to visit. There's not much there, but there's a good vibe. But in the desert around there, so the Sahara only became a desert quite recently, and 5,000 years ago was actually all quite green and verdant, and very well populated. And so you had all these humans living there for thousands of years. And all their tools, all their arrowheads, all their axes and all that stuff, it was all just lying around. But then when it became desertified and the sand all kind of blows all over the place, you have these objects basically just lying all over the desert. And then at the same time, you have a whole load of kind of camel herders who spend the whole time wandering around the desert with camels with not much to do, looking at the sand and picking these things up and sort of bringing them to people. And so you can get these kind of stools in the middle of nowhere with just some sort of old woman there. And it's just this table covered in, like, literally a million-year-old hand axes, meteorites, stone arrowheads. They've just been picked up by these camel herders who have no sense of their value or anything like that, but some sense that maybe there's sort of three tourists a year who come through and might pay some money for them. so that's where that was.
If you ever start like dwelling in volcanoes and sort of wearing black armor and talking about world domination, I know the artifact that I have to kind of prize from your steely grasp. It's that hand axe.
Delicious black.
Yeah.
Still sharp.
I bet it is. It's the one. Yeah. It's the one axe or whatever. okay, well, all right. That is cool. So you're feeling a sort of a, I don't know, what are you feeling? You're feeling an affinity?
It's like, it was fellowship.
Fellowship.
It was like an understanding. So it's not like, oh, wow, this person 5 years ago, but it's more like kind of get the guy 5,000 years ago. Or
is that because you feel like the sensation of you holding it in your hand, you are getting a kind of a direct copy of a sensation that this guy must have had?
I think that's partly it. But at the same time, feeling the utility. Like, this is clearly an excellent stone. Mm-hmm. And I think you can appreciate a good stone or a good stick today as much as someone could, tens of thousands of years ago.
Yeah, and I suppose that particular object is, crude is the wrong word, but it's mono structured, isn't it? It's got no moving parts. It's got nothing bonded. It's just a honed piece of rock.
There aren't many assumptions we made about it. There's not much culture. I mean, it is what it is, very clearly.
But what I mean is that it would be literally just as useful as a hand axe today as it was a million years ago. Which is sets it apart slightly from a lot of artifacts in museums.
Yeah, you're absolutely
right. Which have decayed and obviously. Yeah. And wouldn't be particularly useful. So I guess that's an interesting element there. But what I was going to say was that rather than feeling that kind of connection with, going back in time, I think what's more interesting about a lot of the objects in museums is thinking about it from the perspective of the maker or the user or the owner of the objects when they were actually just everyday objects. Well, I think the most interesting thing about them is that they have survived while their owners, makers, whatever, have not. And that the possibility of that is implicit in every single object that we have. In every single object that we have or we interact with in our lives, there's the implicit possibility that it could, in 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years' time, be in a museum and be interesting as a result.
And also, looking around the objects in this room, like, could give a completely erroneous picture of what I actually
would be very confused with your digging up your house. But I think that's the most interesting part. And in that respect, what a museum it really is, on one level, I think, is every single object in a museum is a memento mori, because somebody owned that or made it or looked at it.
Well, in
the
good museums, that was someone. When it's a mummy or a
that was someone. And now now they're gone, but the object remains. And that's in a way one of the most interesting things about objects is that they are made at a particular time and place for a particular reason, and yet they last, far longer than that context, than that life that engendered them. So they're this sort of, echoes traveling through space and time, long, long after their human lived. And I think it's quite an interesting, that gives an interesting vibe to a museum. I think that's what I get out of it. I'm looking around, I'm thinking, gosh, all these lives, so many lives, so many, and I don't want to sound like corny about it, but you know, so many hopes and dreams and experiences and, you know, all of these kind of things. And now look, you know, the flotsam and jetsam of the, all of those lives is here. And who'd have thought it? You know, you'd love to kind of go back to find the, you know, the man from, you know, I don't know, 16th century Japan who made that particular no mask or whatever in the Bit Rivers and be like, look, mate, I mean, you, that mask that you just made, you're never going to guess.
Famous. Yeah.
You're never going to guess what happens to it. You wouldn't believe it if I told you. But, you know, I've seen it and I'm from the future and it ends up in a museum. Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
So yeah, someone from 500 years in the future, if they came to me and said, oh, yeah, that thing you made, I've seen it.
Yeah. How weird a thought is that? So I think the connection almost works the other way. You know, they're anonymous to us, but the objects would not be anonymous to them.
Yeah, I was reading an account of someone going around kind of house clearance sale after someone had died, and all their kind of precious objects they spent a lifetime kind of accumulating and curating and caring about. You know, families come in, taken what they want, and there's a whole lot of like other stuff. Yeah, I mean, tea sets always get me in antique shops where someone clearly loved this tea set and now it's there for a fiver.
Yeah.
And no one wants it. That's the darker version, I think.
Yeah.
Where it was something that someone cared about and now no one cares about it. Well, whilst for the museum stuff, it's almost the opposite, where these are kind of normal everyday items for the user.
Yes.
But are now special.
Yes, they've been elevated. They've been elevated by being put behind a glass case. Yeah.
Mm.
So, where I was going with that argument was that I don't think that these objects really... I don't think they instantiate really any knowledge or information particularly. You know, you look at an object and, okay, you can kind of infer the technology that made it. You know, if you're particularly knowledgeable about certain techniques and so forth, you might be able to look at it and say, oh, that's been fired in this kind of kiln. But most people, when they go to a museum,
you need to know a lot to get anything out of that.
Yeah. Most people that go to a museum are only going to have the vaguest of sort of intimations of by looking at an object, you know, how it was made. They're only going to have, you can kind of infer uses most of the time, but not always, you know, and who knows whether we're correct in our inferences there. You know, a ladle might well have been used for soup, or it could have been a completely ceremonial priestly object. Like, who knows? You know, you have no idea. So what? You know, it's not like when you're looking at an artifact, you're learning anything. There's no propositional knowledge content that's being communicated to you. So we've established that. But I think that one of the interesting things that can happen in the museum is when they are skillfully curated and skillfully arranged, you can put objects side by side. And in the relationship that you have made between those objects as the curator and the relationship that you perceive as the viewer, there is actually more there than the epistemological sum of its part, than the sum of the parts, right? So if you put a, you know, a Hawaiian spear next to a, I don't know, Macedonian spear, and you put them in the same cabinet side by side, these two objects that are massively, you know, disparate in space and time, in their origins, and then you see the similarities between them, or perhaps the differences, you are discovering and learning a piece of knowledge, and that piece of knowledge is not actually in either of the objects, it's only in their relation. And in that respect, a museum can do something very, very powerful by collecting a diverse range of objects into a single place. You can suddenly start to, get new insights.
So I agree fully with that. And it's ironic that the museum that does it the best, which is the Pitt Rivers Museum, their curators are clearly fighting it somehow. Like, they know it's bad because it's colonialist, because you have, you know, Victorian adventurers going out and getting all those spears and jumbling them all up together in a cabinet. And that doesn't feel very scientific or respectful. And so, you know, that's why museums aren't like the Pitt Rivers anymore, because you've got to... Either that there's this kind of enlightenment drive to categorize things and put them in boxes and separate them out into rooms of, you know, this is the Egypt room and this is the France room. And then there's the whole kind of white self-hatred thing that's going on in museum curation at the moment, where it's all a bit bad. Like, these objects should be back with their people. And the act of collecting them together is problematic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't really talk about the Pyramids Museum without talking about the shrunken heads.
No. Describe
your encounter with the shrunken heads.
Well, we had a WhatsApp exchange about this, didn't we? Because it was the first thing you asked me after I said I'd been to the Pitts Rivers. And I think you said if they still got that, what was the word you used? Did you say the prissy little sort of...
So there's this cabinet full of shrunken heads, which is fundamentally awesome. A whole load of them. And there are some skulls and things like that. And the cabinet is called, like, Treatment of Dead Enemies, with a focus on South America. And now they haven't removed this cabinet. I don't think they've even removed the objects. But what they've done is they've covered all the glass with big stickers saying that, like, this is bad. So you can't see it because it's bad, and you're bad for wanting to see it. Which and made me very angry the first time I saw it. And it still makes me angry now.
Yeah. And what I said, trying to be sort of, you know, reflective and sort of intellectualizing about was that, you know, that cabinet as it stands now in itself is an interesting cultural artifact, right?
And my point is, if you want to have
an object or something that represents a particular feature of modern life, I think that does it quite well. And in a way, that's all I really want to say about the whole shrunken heads thing. You know,
I don't know how you could do it better.
Yeah.
And again, it's not propositional knowledge. It's very aesthetic.
Yeah.
The way it's transferring this knowledge. This point of view about the modern world.
Yeah. It is very aesthetic. There's a sort of, vinyl sticker put on top of a Victorian darkwood cabinet. Yeah. I think that's all we need to say about that.
Yeah.
Personally. there is obviously... I was doing some very brief reading online before we recorded this, and there was a post on the Oxford University Press website about some book on the philosophy of museums or something like that, and it said, of course, most of the philosophical questions raised by museums are ethical in nature. And I thought, I don't think they are at all. I think the ethical questions of museums are relatively few and quite superficial. I think there are much, much more interesting questions than ethical questions about museums. Like, I mean, what does it do to a society when it self-consciously starts to dwell in a scientific sense on other societies? I mean, that is a real phase transition for, I think, a civilization. Full stop. I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about. I don't think it's particularly interesting to think about, you know, is it right or wrong to collect objects? You know, it either is or it isn't according to your morality at the time. You know, like, I don't really see what more you're going to get out of that other than, you know, we either think it's right or we think it's wrong. But regardless, people are interested in doing it and will continue to do so, most likely. I mean, anyway, there we go. There's my thoughts on the matter for what they're worth.
Because, of course, there were some Benin bronzes in the Pitt Rivers as well.
Oh, gosh, yeah, the Benin bronzes. Oh, goodness me.
Past tense.
I mean, where to begin? The Benin bronzes. I mean, it's just... So if you want to, listener, if you know, maybe I'm not going to reveal what I think about the Benin bronzes, but what I would say is that if you want an intelligent, humane analysis, David Abulafia is really good on the Benin bronzes. Now, he does come down on a particular side, but he does raise the actual historical issues that are surrounding the Benin bronzes, which are quite complex.
I'll link to his article. He's a force of good in general. I enjoyed his book on Frederick II.
No, I'm not going to go to the Benin bronzes. I sound like we'll be here all night.
Touching that.
Yeah. Yeah. the morality of it, I mean, I don't know. as I say, I think it either is or it isn't, and I don't think it need, you know, it either is right or it isn't, it need not, you know, concern us any longer here. I'm not going to come down on either side. But I think, you know, what I am interested in is what museums actually are, and what they imply. So here's an interesting thought. I think it's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Right. I think that a society that creates a museum is making a very, very bold, or rather significant claim about itself by doing so. I think. Mm. Because it is, you know, in the sense that consciousness is thought dwelling on thought, right? That's what consciousness is. You know, a museum is a society or a culture dwelling on society and culture. And it's got that meta element to it. You know, it is a kind of shrine to culture, but whose culture? Is it a shrine to the culture of the artifacts that are in it, or the cultures whose artifacts are in the museum? Is it a shrine to them, or is it a shrine to the vessel, as it were, the culture that has collected them together and housed them and put them on display? And, you know, if we, you know, obviously this does touch on the ethical, but I think if you want to approach the ethical question in an interesting way, I think you should reflect on, one should reflect on, which it is, or is it both? And can it be both? And, you know, which one has the upper hand, perhaps, at any given time? I think that, you know, that those are all interesting questions. I don't know, what's your sense? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, what immediately sprung to mind is the fact that, you say, when a society creates a museum, I mean, every country has a national museum.
Well, they do now.
Really terrible. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But like, in the same way that every country has a national anthem, right?
Yeah.
But that's because European countries started having them, and then everyone, because of, you know, European sort of global hegemony in a period of time, everyone thought, well, that's the way you've got to be in order to, you know, mix with the big boys, as it were. And so everyone now has a national anthem, you know.
it's
actually a bit weird, I personally think. You know.
Yeah, we have to sort of stand up and listen to them at the Olympics, yeah.
Yeah.
Where they all seem to be late 19th century.
I find it weird because, you know, there are countries in whose cultural sort of inheritance there's nothing like a sort of national anthem. It makes absolutely no sense. And it's almost like they're saying, well, we're just as good as you because we've got one too. Whereas actually, I think that what you're saying is that you don't have the confidence to be like, we don't need one. This is your thing.
Yeah, we have our own rich musical culture, but we decided to ignore it for the purpose of the national anthem and done something in the kind of German style from 100 years ago, rather.
Yeah, it's a sort of faux, sort of, you know, a faux, what's his name? I don't know. What is his name? I can't think of his name. So annoying. What's his name? The English composer who did like patriotic music. It begins with E.
Elgar.
Faux Elgar or whatever. Yeah, it's like, why do they do that?
Yeah. There were no trumpets in your country until 30 years ago. why are they in your national anthem?
I just think that it's bizarre. And I think that, you know, that it's undermining the precise thing that it's supposed to do, which is, you know, show, I don't know, virility or seriousness or whatever. Anyway, just a personal view there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the same with museums. I've been through some amazing specimens. The Yemeni National Museum is mostly a terrible taxidermy of, like, gifts of stuffed lions that the president's been given.
Mm.
And items of significance to the president. Like, so the ex-president Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was very nearly assassinated with a car bomb, and in a glass case in the middle of the museum is the trousers he was wearing on that day. They've been ripped to shreds by the blast.
Oh, it's a bit like Hitler's trousers, isn't it? Is that something that might not have occurred to him? Didn't they have Hitler's trousers from the bombing in the Wolfschanze or whatever?
And really? Sort
of ripped. I think so. I think I've seen a picture of them.
That probably didn't occur to him.
No. I'm not casting any aspersions on this. Well, for all I know, very upstanding Yemeni leader.
Yeah,
I just think it's an unfortunate congruence there.
In summary, National Museum suck, but a different sort of thing. You're saying they're kind of cargo culting, like the country thinks they need one, so they create one.
Yeah, I think it's a form of almost cultural cringe.
And amusing, actually, a lot of the countries that have their kind of National Museum, which is terrible, will have a whole load of like private museums or random museums that are incredible.
Yeah. And I'm really, really, I hope I don't come across as sort of, I don't know, patronizing or insulting to these countries, because what I'm actually saying is that you don't need to ape these kind of, you know, Europeanizing Western forms, because I think unless you actually feel the kind of cultural need to do so not from the wish to ape or for prestige, but instead because you feel the urge to do what museums actually do.
Not glorify the great leader.
Yeah. In which case, I think, obviously, you know, crack on. I think there's a weird dynamic of sort of performative stuff going on there. Anyway, I hope that makes sense.
Classifying those as museums for the purpose of this.
And the thing is that obviously, like, you found that museum experience very funny, but I know that you have a lot more respect for Yemeni culture than most other cultures around the world.
Well, what we've been saying about the museum giving an aesthetic experience, I certainly got one there. Vibe. The music ended. Yeah. Like, I came out a different person than I went in.
Yeah.
Not in the way I expected. But then some of the unexpected museums are Barcelona has the worst Egyptology museum ever. But the problem is, because they don't have any of the big ticket items, they don't have the mummies, they don't have the kind of golden caskets, they don't have all the stuff you think about when you think about ancient Egypt. What they have is like the sweepings, but that's really interesting because you don't normally see them, because when you're in the Egyptology museum of a proper country, you only get, you know, the Tutankhamun stuff. And so it really struck me that this one is just full of like beaded necklaces and things like that.
Yeah.
And the entire vibe was extremely African in a way I hadn't considered before.
Mm.
It made Egypt look like an African culture.
Which it was.
Yeah. But it kind of placed it very firmly within that in a way that most museums that just have kind of cool gold stuff do not. So there is value in terrible museums.
Well, there's value in seeing things. There's value in the obscure, isn't there? There's value in the thing that is not usually seen.
The unexpected.
The unexpected. Yeah. I think it's a bit harsh, implying that Spain is not a proper country. Sorry, Spanish listeners. All countries are proper countries. Just want to make that clear.
A proper capital city.
Right.
It's unusual to have a museum of Egyptology in your second city.
I'd say even by sort of chauvinistic Eurocentric standards, saying that Spain isn't a proper country is quite a claim. It's one of the biggest European sort of, you know, colonizers and you know, cultural centres and all of this kind of thing.
I've got nothing. Yeah. and to this day, major industrial power that no one
And
really
to this
expects.
Day, yeah, a very important and beloved nation. What I was wanting to get to, and I think that that's a useful way of approaching it, is that I'm not quite sure whether a museum is saying more about it. I think that a museum is first and foremost, actually, I'm going to come down on this side, a statement about the culture which has created the museum, rather than about the cultures that are represented within the museum. And I think that that is probably one of the things that the, you know, let's say for the sake of argument, the curators within the Pitt Rivers today intuitively understand or intuit and are uncomfortable with. Because any cultural claims that we wish to make about ourselves in the modern context are problematic, I think. Because as soon as you plant your flag, as it were, anywhere, morally or ethically, when we're talking about our culture or our civilization, you are, by definition, being that great evil thing of the modern world, which is exclusive. Because as soon as you stake a position, well, by logical necessity, you are saying, well, we don't hold that position over there, and we don't hold that position over there. So I think that museums, in their very nature, stake a particular position in a kind of cultural sense. And I think that that position is something along the lines of, we value, I don't know, what is it? Understanding, knowledge, categorization. I don't know. I'm not quite clear on what it is, actually. What the actual cultural claim is.
I think it's changed over time, because in the Enlightenment it was about classifying understanding. Whilst before that it was about being adventurous and maybe visiting new lands or conquering new lands, or even just we're wealthy enough to acquire these objects.
I see. I think that maybe what it would be in a more modern world would be that we are creative, confident, open-minded enough to be more interested in looking at your stuff than looking at our stuff. You know, that's how, you know, creative, and that's how fecund our culture is that we've run out of, you know, we've got time to spare, we've got intellectual capacity to spare, not only to be absorbed just simply in our own aesthetic, but to be plundering your aesthetic to inspire us further.
Yeah, I mean, most museums aren't like that, though. I mean, I'm sure there's museums in Bath that are just like stuff from around Bath, or, you know, every regional town has a little local museum that isn't making any international claims at all. It's like, here's some coins from down the road.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, you're absolutely right. I hadn't really thought about those museums at all when thinking about this. I'd almost go so far as to say, in my mind, they're not really the same thing. I think that what I'm talking about is the museum with a capital M, along the lines of the Pitt Rivers, where, and I suppose what that is something that was born out of the era of exploration, globalization, and colonialism. You know, the era in which the world was, you know, opened up in quotation marks by Europeans, very strongly in quotation marks. Don't want to get cancelled. I suppose that I'm thinking of a museum in that sense. I'm thinking of museums like the British Museum, you know, where universal museums, that's what they're called, isn't it? Universal museums.
Yeah, of course. So, and although, I mean, the British Museum does have plenty of English stuff in there, but it's within the context of a whole world of stuff. Like the Sutton Hoo treasure would be interesting, even if it wasn't from England.
Yeah. I think that it's a bit like, there's a certain cultural arrogance which you can't hide about a universal museum. It's about having the capacity and the breadth to be interested and to collect, to be a collector. There's something about being a collector collecting things has an implicit claim to superiority and control. I think that's why people like collecting things, because it is putting oneself in the place of a sort of controller.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, because, I mean, you think of collecting as in, you know, there's some inherent satisfaction in classifying stuff, but actually it's the possession of it.
And the classification and ordering, putting everything in its right place. Aligning it all according to a scheme that you have designed and you have created and that suits you. you know, you're kind of in a small, sort of slightly absurd way taking on the role of the sort of the creator or the deity, aren't you? And you are ordering a little part of the universe according to your whim.
Yeah, it's not abstract like a Mororoia, which I think Mororoia kind of hits some of the same same marks. But you're doing it with a world of real stuff that was owned by real people or made by real people.
Yeah, he's saying we're putting you all in order. You know, and you can go in the spear cabinet with your spear there, and you can go next to the Macedonian spear, and you know we are putting them together, and we are getting the insight and the knowledge.
Mm.
There is an implicit claim, isn't there? There is an implicit superiority.
Yeah, so we're saying that some extra knowledge comes from the arrangement of things, or the curation of things, or the placement of things next to each other, and the only person who's going to get the benefit of that knowledge is the person who does that.
Mm.
So we're getting some additional value from these objects by collecting them all together and putting them in a room that you wouldn't have if you only had your spears.
Yeah. And you, it's not like you're going to be doing the same to us.
Well, you can come here and pay to look at our museum.
Yes.
We'll allow that.
Yes.
On our terms.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what is being intuited by the people that are uncomfortable with it. Now, I think that do I think that that is a necessary way of thinking about it? Or do I think that that's just a... No, I don't think it's wrong either, but does it have to be that way? That's the question.
Well, the problem is, if we say there's this extra knowledge you get from arranging things in this manner, and that extra knowledge is a useful thing, the only way you're going to get that extra knowledge is from having done this.
Yeah.
And so if we reject this as a concept, we're losing that access to the muses.
Yeah.
And that would be bad.
It's one of those cruel little ironies about the real world, isn't it? Where in order to achieve some aesthetic things, morally questionable things have to be done.
Well, you've got to accept that not everyone can do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not everyone can do it.
There's only one Mona Lisa. It can only be in one place.
Yeah, I think that's probably a better way of looking at it, actually. Yeah, only some people can. Only some can do it.
Mm.
And is it wrong for them to do so? Because of that fact.
Yeah. And again, there's a big question of all attempts to make mankind more equal. They do want to cut down the tool trees or
it's really plans. Annoying that having rubbished the idea of ethical questions earlier in the podcast, we're now ending on an ethical question. Talk about looking like absolute mugs, or me anyway. You're fine.
What a mug.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's an ethical question. I think it's obvious it's a good thing.
Well, I think it's obvious that it will happen because it gives that benefit.
Well, I think we go back to it. Doesn't matter if it's good or not, it is.
I'm not just being cowardly by refusing to come down on the answer on is it good or is it not. I just don't think that it's, I almost don't think it's relevant. But what I do think is that that's where those who do want to think about whether it's good or not, I think that that is what is going on. If I've unpacked, you know, what's going on with why they feel this and what's the ethical tension, I think it's in that. It's that implicit claim to superiority that comes from collection and organization and curation. Curation is an implicit claim to mastery.
Yep.
And there we go, on that bombshell. I feel like I'd ramble on quite a lot more about this.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of side alleys. Went unexplored.
But we have been going on an hour now. I feel like curation is mastery is a nice place to stop.
Yeah, and curation is the value of museums.
Yeah. Controversial episode. I hope we don't get cancelled for it. Just wandering blindly into the whole museum thing.
One of our plenty listeners.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I've said anything terrible.
You were very careful not to. You didn't talk about the Benin Bronzes?
No, I refused to talk about them.
To an ethical stance?
I didn't. But is refusing to commit to an ethical stance enough to... enough to condemn me? Probably.
It may be. Maybe.
Oh, well. Let's take the risk.
Find out.
Yep. And on that, second bombshell. goodbye, everybody.
Bye.